About 2.5 years ago, celebrity photographer Scott Passfield lost work due to the poor economy, so he went on an adventure to travel to all 50 states, including Alaska and Hawaii, to capture the stories and photos of everyday gay men.
His book, Gay in America, presents a beautiful, diverse look at gay men at their most intimate moments at home. The book is not just a testament to Scott Passfield's ability to bond with his subjects, but it also illustrates how the internet brings gay men from all walks of life together.
Join us as we talk with Scott in the home studio about why he thought it was so important to make this book.
Gay Amish couples, unusual love triangles, forever aloners, and the quiet dignity of brave everyday folks.
The work of Richard Avedon.
Coping with your subjects when they have a change of heart or even die.
Did Scott hook up with any of the guys in his book? Find out.
Plus all the hot news. Anna Grodzka becomes the first openly trans woman to be elected to the Polish parliament.
Rosie returns to TV. Should we give Ro-Ro a break?
Actors in zombie makeup confuse the hell out of paramedics in Toronto.
And too hot for NPR, Ira Glass's secret sex tape. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. You are listening to today's show because it was made possible by people just like you.
You did it.
You did it right now, and so we thank you so much. But we have one more thing to ask. How about going to podcastawards.com and voting for your favorite podcast, Feast of Fun? Why should they do it, Mark?
The Podcast Awards recognize excellence in podcasting, and we hope that the listeners think that this show deserves it.
We humbly ask you for your vote. And if you like the show and you think it is worth it, please vote. Podcastawards.com. Today, photographer Scott Passfield joins us to talk about his remarkable new book, Gay in America, in which he traveled to meet gay men in all 50 states, but not Puerto Rico.
Could be a whole nother book.
Did you go to Hawaii?
I did. Yes.
You went to Hawaii and he met all these people on the internet to document their lives. He's in the home studio. The book is Gay in America. We urge you to get it. It's a gorgeous photography. How many pages is this book, Scott?
224.
And they're luscious, full color photography of people, everyday people from all walks of life, gay men, and sharing their most intimate moments all around the country. What got you started wanting to do this kind of book about gay men in America?
It's a good question. Well, you know, I think, you know, many factors contributed to me doing this book. The economy slowed down. I had more time on my hands. I also found myself not too happy shooting more and more jobs for money to stay in business and doing corporate headshots and things that sort of took me away from the love of photography. And I decided that I had to go out and create my dream job, that nobody was going to hand it to me. And so
going to strangers' homes and taking pictures of them is your dream job.
And cruising
it
for
is.
Them online.
Yeah, exactly. Looking all online.
That is a good job.
I had lots of men sending me naked pictures of themselves. And it was tough. You know, my partner was always like, "You're working, right?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm working." But
fap, fap, fap.
You know, and my dog also died. I've had her for 14 years. So I had a lot more free time on my hands. And I had always wanted to combine a road trip with photography, but I needed a purpose and a catch and an idea, I think, to turn it into a book. And,
when did the genesis for the idea erupt? Was this like 2 years ago, 4 years
about
ago?
About 2.5. Yeah. February of 2008.
And so you were like in kind of like in a crisis mode at the time.
Actually, I was. I was really miserable with many things in my life. Yeah. And, you know, I had moved to New York and I was there for, you know, 15 years and I really only planned on being there 10. I would rather go to a smaller market and be a bigger fish somewhere. I had created a great portfolio from those years in New York. But my partner is, you know, born and bred in New York and has the job that make can keep us afloat, and so
he's one of the 1%.
Yeah, and his mom is a little older, and you know, we take care of her on the weekends and check in on her. So
you're kind of stuck.
We're
in
stuck
the
there. Yeah, exactly. We're
so
stuck
this was
there.
Kind of like your way to get out.
It was
for
my
a
escape.
Bit.
Yeah, and it was great. I mean, I planned 2 week trips, no more than 2 weeks at a time. I would head out with the car and my equipment, and you know, move at a really fast pace, and. You know, and walk into everybody's lives, and it became fascinating to me.
What was really the process did. Like for, how did you find these gentlemen?
For the most part, I would put ads in various different online community and chat groups, whether it was Facebook or Craigslist, mm-hmm. and everything in between, really.
So you'd go from men seeking men on Craigslist.
On Craigslist, exactly.
And
yeah.
be like, I'm a photojournalist, I want to take your picture, and I want your story.
I told them, I used the word celebrity photographer, and I would say, I'm coming to your town, and uh-huh. I would really, you know, I'm looking for out proud mm-hmm. gay men who are happy with their lives, doing what they want, where they want. And, you know, I wish that there was a book that existed when I was a kid that showed me all the options I had. And, you know, we all don't have to go to a big city and live a certain life that I think, you know, people think gay men do. And so once the idea, you know,
and drugs won't be involved.
Right. No. Yeah.
I'm party and play photographer.
Well, you know, because let's face it, if you're trying to, you know, find people to photograph on Craigslist, they're going to think you're coming on to them.
Well, I mean, when they go to my website and they see, you know, sort mm-hmm. of the legitimacy of me, I think they knew, you know, I would say that, you know, these are
closed pictures.
I
know some
pictures.
Of these famous photographers, and I know sometimes they use it like, you know, Rufus Wainwright, I can't pronounce his name, but he used to be in bars and go up to at the low point of his drug abuse. He admits to this, he would go up to hot guys in bars and says, if you come home and sleep with me, I'll write a song about you in my next album. And he did.
Well, I never used that.
Cigarettes and chocolate milk is about Mark.
As a means to get in the book, ever, you know?
I mean, so you pretty kept this on the level.
True.
And you were very professional about the people. But I would imagine that a lot of the people, I know I'm going right there in the beginning of the interview, but so some of these people came on to you because you're very attractive, hot wolf daddy kind of type.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think if I was, you know, if I didn't have those qualities, it would have been much more difficult for me to convince people to take the time. It would take 2 to 3 hours. You know, I'd have to, come to their world, set up lighting, mm-hmm. and not everybody was that willing, you know, at first. You know, so having a good-looking face helped, I think, you know.
Let's talk about the first person you got in contact with in the book. Who is that?
The very first was somebody from New York City, they are not in the book, actually.
So who's the first person?
They got edited out?
They...
You were too ugly to be in the book.
No, he just was really, I guess, averse to sharing his story. He didn't want to write it down for us in the end, and he promised he would, but he never came through, so...
Did you get a lot of that? Did you get people that said they wanted to be involved, and then when they thought about, like, the ramifications, or after they went through the process, were like... Let me pull back.
Well, we had to go back to everybody in the end and get new releases that specifically granted copyright of the text they had written in the emails to me for the book. And the release seemed somewhat daunting when you read you're giving up all rights to your words. And that, you know, I'd say there were about 9 shoots that backed out. Mm. Some of these, you know, a few of them were young and... they went back in the closet and they told me that things had changed and that I couldn't understand, you know, their life and their work situation.
Wow.
And that's just the way it was. So it was upsetting, but, you know, I had to respect that.
So most of the people that didn't want to do it were younger people?
I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. One older guy, I think, did want to sleep with me. And and in the end, his corporate lawyer, he said, you know, said he would be foolish to sign this release. So, mm-hmm. you know, but the cream rose to the surface. All these guys that backed out after seeing, you know, what they really were about and their reasons for backing out, it made perfect sense.
Well, I can imagine, you know, because you were sort of in an emotionally vulnerable position at the time, financially vulnerable, being unemployed. And you're meeting these people and you're thinking, well, what if this doesn't work?
Right,
you know, you're meeting the first guy in New York, well, obviously seemed like a nightmare. You left town. Who was like the first person who made you think, hey, there's something in this book. This something can be incredible here.
You know, the first few, I shot a guy named Will in Vermont who was HIV positive and just was so honest with his story and really personal stuff. And I realized the, you know, how strong that honesty was and sure. how we normally don't see that. You know, I think, you know, most people would think that I would be out there photographing the most fabulous, the, you know, the wealthiest, the A-list gays.
Riken Limecool.
Right. Riken.
Lance yeah, Bass. Right. Is Lance Bass in this book?
No, I asked. You know, I wasn't good enough for any of those guys. They, you know.
Oh, so they declined.
Well, I wrote to a lot of people, you know, thinking, oh, you know, originally maybe it would help sell the book mm-hmm. if there was somebody, you know, great in there or well known. You know, but it never worked out because they had to take a leap of faith. There was no publisher on board. Mm-hmm. They had to, you know, believe in just being in the project, you know, and mm-hmm. that was, you know, I had dreams of it making it into a book, but there was no guarantee.
So let's talk about the HIV positive man. I guess I don't want to characterize somebody by the chronic illness that they have, but the guy who lived in Vermont.
Right.
How did you build that trust with them initially? You just, you know, Terry Gross from NPR says, I just simply asked. I mean, was that the same approach that
Pretty
you
did? Pretty much. I asked. I told them my purpose, what I had hopes to do, and that I really wanted to, you know, open minds and change opinions with this and educate some people. Mm-hmm. And maybe as to the realities of gay men in the country, mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people, you know, in smaller places think they don't know gay people. And, mm-hmm. it, you know, I wanted to prove them wrong and show them that, you know, there's plenty of gay people, you know, some guy living next door could be gay and they just have no idea because it doesn't fit their stereotype of what they think a gay guy is.
And you certainly have a lot of homely people in the book.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. But
well, you know, in a sense, who is the photographer
real people.
We were talking about before we started taping that did those
Bruce
wonderful.
Weber.
No.
Avedon.
Richard Avedon.
Right.
Who did these wonderful full body, gritty portraits of people in America. And I see this as the gay modern day equivalent of that.
That is awesome to hear. Because he's a hero of mine.
You can use that in your right, publicity. Yeah. I just
quote
said that.
Andy, my publicist
modern
should
day
be listening.
Gay yeah. equivalent of Richard Avedon. And rewrite, fix my grammar, please, publisher. But so I don't sound like a you know a person who just stumbled out of bed. But
But I respect Avedon yeah. for taking portraits that reveal someone's true soul in a way. And a lot of times they are not flattering. So that was a difficult line to walk with people. I wasn't there to flatter them. I wanted to reveal their, you know, their inner workings and something that would, you know, that would help people understand them. And a lot of times that wasn't a smiling shot. Mm-hmm. If their story was kind of depressing, I had to, you know, get a shot that would be reflective of the words they wrote. And I would send them pictures after the shoot. I would, you know, pick my favorite
That's
handful
a terrible
of shots.
Mistake.
And, you know, but they...
and they used them for their first Facebook profile.
And a lot
profile.
Of people didn't like. I would say, you know, I'll send you the images because I didn't have the money or time mm-hmm. to make people prints. So I would just give them some low-res images and say, you know, have at it, use them on your Facebook page or whatever, you know, share them with your friends. And, you know, hopefully, you know, one day we'll have a book that you'll get.
You
know?
You didn't slather it with your like logo on top of their picture.
No,
like some
no.
photographers.
No,
do,
you know? Yeah. No, no watermarking. Right.
Okay. Let's look at the story of Eric. He's in Noblesville, Indiana. Why don't you read his short.
Sure. And Eric yeah. is coming tonight to the Barnes & Noble, I believe. Lives in Indianapolis, and here's his story. He says, my childhood was not easy. I was raised by a very religious mother, and I still struggle with issues regarding my faith to this day. A small part of me is scared that I will actually go to hell. I try to convince myself that no God would make me this way and then send me to that place. I avoid going to church. I don't have anything against Christians, but I mostly feel that religion is for people who can't really think for themselves. I know what is right and what is wrong. So I just try to do the right thing and enjoy my life.
Wow.
I mean, that's intense, you know? Mm-hmm. And what connected me to Eric is, you know, that that guilt you feel from the religion that was forced on you growing up and how we all are told that being gay is a sin. And he still, to this day, has a little part of him that feels he's going to hell. So,
well, I think a lot of these gay men would benefit from reading, like, feminist theory of the good girl, bad girl, slut thing. Because you see on all these online profiles, I don't do hookups, or the complete opposite, like, you know, must have 100 cocks in my ass right now.
Right now, yeah.
You know, and so this dichotomy is really tied to, I know this sounds like a cliche here, shame. It's that we have this kind of like dark little demon inside us that says to us, we either have to be compulsive about the sex that we want to have, or we have to erase it completely and form ourselves into monogamous, very regular, very traditional relationships, because otherwise we're bad people. And we're not like those other gays.
Right.
And what I think is really powerful about your book is that it shows gay men in a variety of different ways. You know, I would have liked to have seen like some, you know, some drag queen out of makeup, you know, in their closet.
There is.
Yeah. There is one.
There,
okay.
There is one. Yeah.
I didn't get to see that page, but you know, I really stricken by the polyamorous couples that you put into the book, which Triplets. Is something. Which is something
trios.
That you don't...
The triads, right?
Triads, yeah. Is that what they're called?
Okay. Yes, right.
I always think of, like, what is the Japanese mafia when you say triad?
But, you know, and the people who are forever alone, and then the people who are, like, you know, swingers, and even the Amish couple, like...
Right, yeah. I think he was brought up Mennonite, but he loves that look. And, that's a little disconcerting for some people to see a guy dressed in Amish... clothing with the beard and
it's what he finds sexy.
Exactly, you know. I think it's sort of sexy, you know.
I grew up in Pennsylvania, yeah. So it's like sometimes you see some of these Amish boys, and some of them were always very, very cute.
But I think this is really powerful, and I think this is critical to the success and the reception of this book, because as gay men, we're so surrounded by elitism and this irrational fascination with. You're showing me the picture of the drag queen.
That's the drag queen. He won the Miss Iowa at Large. Yeah. So.
Oh, he's large. That's not what that means. That means you.
He's right. Big.
No, it's that gave you the title or something like that.
Okay. So, but anyways, that we're so like, I find these like out 100 lists to be kind of douchey and annoying, and it's not really reflective of who we are, and it's more like driven by publicists and advertisers.
Right. Or their success from a monetary standpoint, or their careers that have just, you know, they've become famous.
It's like MTV's Cribs, you know? You're like,
but what do you learn from them? Not much.
You don't learn anything about them as people. And I feel like this is really cool, because as a voyeur and as people that we do interviews with people every single day, it's very satisfying, because you get to very quickly and very intensely get to know the person behind the photograph. And I think that's commendable. And, you know, if I can describe any kind of book as honorable, I think this really captures that well. And I don't. You know, because we get a lot of crappy LGBT books coming this way, you know, and so that's why I recommend people actually getting this. Christmas is around the corner, or Hanukkah, or somebody's birthday. And I think it actually Glitter Day. It makes an actually really good book.
Yeah. And we should actually say, isn't today National Coming Out Day? I believe
it is. But by the time people hear it, it'll be tomorrow. The 12th.
So,
thank you so much for those words. That's the best thing that I could hear about this book, you know.
But it's being really well received, actually. Like, everybody from the high, low press, even, you know, GLAAD, which is, you know, usually like, how many celebrities are in your book?
Right.
I'm not interested in, you know, even them are gushing
over it. They got really behind it. Yeah.
And I think that's really commendable that you've managed to take the stories of about 50 everyday people.
105 in the book.
And 105, I'm sorry, but in 50 states in the country.
Oh, exactly, right.
And celebrating them and creating us to be interested in our everyday selves. That's revolutionary.
Wow, that is awesome to hear.
Let's talk about a few of the people that you profile in the book. There's people in single, there's, you know, couples, and then there's a couple that's a triad. Let's talk about one of your triads.
Sure. Well, you know, I think probably two-thirds of the book are single people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's somewhat reflective, I think, of the gay community, too. You know, we're not all in, you know, wonderful relationships. More often than not, we are single and we're out having a good time. But I heard from some triads, and that sparked, you know, my interest, because I wasn't that familiar with those sort of relationships, you know, and they were very honest in why they were together and what they got out of it. So I had three guys in Buffalo, New York, who were very, you know, young, in their late 20s, who've been together for 9 years now. And they wrote to me and said, we're a monogamous triad. And just that terminology.
They were wanting to add you to their fourth.
No, I was, there was a part of me that, you know, that wanted to, become the fourth. But they... you know, they have a closed relationship. They don't have an open, you know, sex orgy. And you know, I think that maybe most people, when they hear of, you know, three guys together, they think it's just a wild orgy. And, you know, they have a closed relationship. They can live out their fantasies, but they're very safe doing so. And that was interesting to me.
Did you ever ask them, like, because usually in three-way monogamous group relationships, and actually, you know, not the first people I've met or heard about that way, I usually ask them, is like, who came in who first into the relationship, into the atomic nucleus of your relationship?
I think you are right that probably two of them started dating first, but they quickly found that third. And they realized the power and love they had for all, you know, the three of them. And I think, you know, in describing their relationship, initially they did have a lot more of, you know, an open relationship with other people coming in, participating, and, you know, young guys, though, living out their fantasies.
Because they're all about the same age, and they're all same kind of body type.
And they met
young. Decided to close it off, though. They didn't want to risk anything. Mm-hmm. They loved each other. They realized that, you know, three of them, they could do all sorts of things, but they, you know.
And they sleep in, what is it,
two king-size beds? Oh, yeah, I said they had two king-size beds pushed up together. And
One is
right.
Higher.
One was like on a box spring, and then the other was on a box spring and a frame support. So, you know, they were like, you know, a mattress width apart from each other. And I just thought that was interesting to not have them all level. And they said, you know, you have no idea how handy that comes in. And I was like, just imagining, you know, what is that? I can see, you know, usually, you know,
that must be
we might put some pillows underneath somebody. You don't have to do it there. You know,
that's a big bedroom then to accommodate two
big buffalo house. It was a huge, you know, old Victorian home that the three of them had bought. So, you know,
Gay is living in a Victorian home. I can't imagine.
Me and my partner have been together a long time, and we have, you know, he makes more money than I do, and we have some real estate in New York. We have a little, two little places outside of the city that we go to. I'm spoiled rotten, but I often joke with him and say, you know, a third would make a whole lot of sense, you know, to just take care of all the places.
Well, that's the thing is, like, you know, in these three group relationships, what, you know, all relationships are unequal by nature, but usually what happens is one person gets really lazy and treats the other two as their personal servants. And then that lazy person then starts cheating outside of the relationship.
Right.
And the whole thing goes to hell.
Yeah. Well, Muhammad said you should always have four wives, because you can't have two wives because they'll argue with each other. You can't have three wives because then two will pick on one. So you have to have four wives so that each can, you know, have a partner.
Now, you know a lot of people, and you're a professional photographer. You're in New York City. Lots of people in media. Did anybody get like jealous or go, was like, why didn't you include
Always.
Me in the book?
A lot of people
Mark
said,
Mark and I were like, why aren't we in the book?
Exactly. Why? But once
we
I started
on Craigslist to answer his ad.
It was a very easy way to deflect that, you know, responsibility or awkwardness that I might feel in not selecting a friend. Mm-hmm. So I always said that I didn't want to know any of the people in the book. And I didn't, you know, people would always come to me and say, my friend is perfect for your book. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, I'd rather not include them, because then if it makes me feel awkward, if I don't feel their story is right for the book, then I feel guilty in some way and it makes you look bad. So I would say, you know, you could tell them about the project. Mm-hmm. If they really want to be a part of it, they need to write me a story that's open and honest about their life and you know, some wisdom they have for the younger generation or things they've learned along the line. And, you know, never did it work
out. I do the same thing.
Nobody ever wrote.
People write to us all the time the same thing. I'm just like, have them send us their talking points.
Right.
You never hear.
You never hear from
them. But you do have a friend in the book.
In the end, after I found a publisher, they gave me the opportunity to shoot some more people. And I asked the editors, you know, what do you think is missing? Are we missing a certain age or race or, you know, you know? And they said, we really think you should have some winter scenes, you know? And that kind of hit me out of left field. It wasn't what I was expecting. Mm-hmm. And it was winter. And I went out and, you know, on one particular trip, and I photographed Dan Choi in a winter scene, and these guys from Rhode Island, and my friend Charlie, and he's like the one person I asked to be in the book that was a friend, and just because his story I felt was really unique, and he was young, living in rural Vermont, and he was a forester. And
Charlie's hot. He looks like Jake Gyllenhaal. He's the of all the people in the book,
he does look like Jake Gyllenhaal. Yeah.
I would be the one first one in line to have sex with.
And I love the photo is like right out. It's a very common, almost like Norman Rockwell.
So let me read a little bit really fast here. Growing up, the only gay role models I had were on TV. Characters like Jack from Will and Grace, ugh, or what I could dig up on the internet. They were people I had no connection with, even though at the time they were more or less defined by what the concept meant to be gay. And I really didn't want any part of that. I was a guy, not a fag.
That's great. I mean,
it is true. It's like, and just think of like, you know, these kids, they grew up with Jack, but I mean, you go back, that character really hasn't changed. It was the same for me growing up on soap. It was Billy Crystal. Right. And like, nobody wanted to be cringeworthy. Billy Crystal.
But you know, the internet, I mean, really this book is also a testament to the internet and the fact that you can find these kind of people. And so, you know, yes, in popular culture, we're going to have characters that are pretty colorful because they're trying to attract an audience. But if you really want to get the answer, who are gay men? All you need to do is turn around to Google, to social networks, and start poking around.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the social networking worked really well. I mean, I think it's connected the gay community across the country like nothing else. And, you know, bars are closing left and right. And, you know, it's certainly a way to connect to our community. The internet has changed things drastically.
And I wish that Robert, the 44-year-old gray-haired bear daddy, would have been on the cover and not Dan Choi.
We love Dan Choi, though.
I love Dan Choi, but
this photo is really, I mean, it's a remarkable, I mean, that's Americana right
exactly,
there.
Exactly.
It's a guy, it's a cowboy, a guy in a cowboy hat. There's a gas container in the back. What is that?
Propane tank.
Right. It's the middle
sitting
of
on
America.
A stump.
Sitting on a stump.
It's my favorite photo. One of my favorite photos in the book. And here he says that he, let's see, a lot has changed for me over the past year. Probably the biggest thing that I found out was I had diabetes. I can't say I was shocked to hear the doctor diagnose me. Anyone over 300 pounds would have to live in a fantasy world to be surprised by that. It was my wake-up call. Since then, I have lost somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 pounds, and I weigh a slim 284.
He was great. I mean, that was a great example of how the project and me photographing people really touched them. I mean, he was a large guy and I came into his world and, you know, tried to really show his amazing personality. And when I sent him those photos after the shoot, he wrote me the nicest letter and said how he had never seen photographs that really showed the true him. And he was able to see through that fat to the person underneath and how he thanked me for that. And that sort of, you know, that started in wheels, the motion, you know, to lose weight. And, you know, I felt so honored that I could in some way help people with my photography that had never.
I think that's why we photograph ourselves so much as this generation is because we have the tools, but it's a way about understanding and creating a mental picture that's healthy and constructive about who we are at the moment that we are, you know? And it's like, because not all of us can have a professional photographer come take our picture.
Right.
So what we're doing is we're learning how to, this generation of people, I think, we're turning around with our new iPhone 4S's available in the Apple store, that you can photograph yourself in high resolution and really create some phenomenal photos.
And it's also putting photographers out of business all over the place. So,
yeah, because you know, you can just launch your gay dating iPhone app and get the sloppy version of this book.
Of this book, sure.
But you know,
you don't get the story behind it. You just get more cock shots and things like that. Now, did you ever have people like you got their story, and then when you got there, you're like, this doesn't really ring true to me.
Yeah,
I don't really want
to. Not that, they were lying to you.
Not that most. I mean, most everybody in back and forth, you can tell when somebody is being honest and when they're not. But sometimes they would trip up and they would, you know, send me photographs that were 20 years old along with their story. Mm-hmm. And then like one guy in Florida, after, you know, chatting with me for days, sent, you know, I said, these pictures kind of look old to me. They were shot on film. And I think, you know, are they recent? And he said, oh, well, here's a recent picture of me. And he sent me one that just really didn't look like the same person at all. Mm-hmm. And this was after communicating for a week. So I felt like he had in some way he wasn't truthful with me. Mm-hmm. And when I questioned on him, he got very defensive and said, you know, you're just out to, you know, this is just a sexual trip for you, isn't it? Because I'm old. That's not why you don't want to include me now. And I said, you know, you were lying to me, basically. So I'm more upset with that. You weren't being honest. I had repeatedly asked you for recent photos. And, you know, up until the very last moment, then you revealed that it, in fact, wasn't a recent photo.
Because you, in fact, have
and people. And he really got upset. So, and he kind of stalked me and sent me emails after, you know, and
he's listening
and they
to
were
this
nice,
right now.
You know, so I, you know, I said, thank goodness I didn't include him because it kind of would have turned into a nightmare. Another guy that I've shot who didn't make the book, who wasn't truthful so much. He lived at home with his parents and he was in his mid-40s. His older brother still lived at home. They had a very, you know, what most people would consider a dysfunctional household. It was very, it hadn't been cleaned in probably 20 years. And when I got there, he had never mentioned that he lived at home with his parents. And they were out at work and they didn't know anything about the shoot. So I felt somewhat awkward because he wasn't being truthful with his parents. It was their house. And he also hadn't told me, you know, some of the more specifics. He wasn't all there. He was a little slow. He hadn't showered in a while. He, you know, it
That's
just...
some of gay America, though.
I mean, I was surprised. It's not what most people think. But I was walking around feeling, you know, I was always inspired by the men in the book. So in this instance, I was questioning. I wasn't that inspired. And but I ended up staying and photographing him. And I used words... to you know, like
Who's
I do
he?
With everybody, he's not in the book.
Oh, he
the story
didn't make
goes
it.
On, but he. I used words. I said, "Hold it, that is beautiful, right there, and you are gorgeous, right there." Whatever adjectives I described him, but he, you know, I left. I went home. I sent him the pictures, and again, another lovely note came to me, and he told me that no one had ever used those words to describe him before in his life, and how special that was for him, and how I made him feel really special. And subsequently, he passed away from diabetes and poor circulation. And, you know, all his friends wrote to me afterwards and said how moving the experience was for him and how they thanked me for doing that for him. And, you know, as it turns out, I had to go back to people, like I said, for new releases in the end. And his parents refused to let him be in the book. So because, you know,
it was like Brokeback Mountain.
I was devastated for the poor guy, but I had to respect the parents, you know, and, you know, at least even though he's not in the book, I made him feel so special.
Before he died.
Before he died. I gave him that gift, and I'll never forget it.
Now, he's not the only person that's died since you've started
this
book.
No, there's four people in the book that have died.
What are you doing to these
people? I know, I feel like
you have a gay in America.
The Black Widow.
The gay in America
curse. It sounds like an X-Files something. You take their picture, and then they die.
Yeah, so Tom died, and he didn't make the book.
What did Tom die from?
Complications from diabetes.
Okay,
and I also, Chris, who is in the book, I photographed from Kansas, and he was a young guy, 26. He was
really hot.
He's kind of hot. Yeah, he was dating two men at the time when I photographed him, and
they didn't know it though, right?
Right, and he was telling me the story how he really wanted to pick one, and he couldn't, you know, continue on dating both. So he decided on one after
they were out of his league
after the photo shoot, and and 3 months later, he was spending the first weekend with the chosen boyfriend, and went out for a motorcycle ride in the afternoon. And a mile from his house, got hit by you know, a car and died instantly. And
actually, it
ended up that you know, the boyfriend wrote to me and said, "We need a shot for the wake. Would you know, send one?" Of course, I did. And he told me that Chris really loved the project, believed in it, and if there was any way he could be part of it, he would be so honored. And he told me his story about being married with kids. And turns out the other boyfriend was also, you know, a father with young children from a previous marriage as well. But they ended up meeting at the bar where they all originally met months after the funeral. Their eyes connected across the dance floor. And they had started a relationship. And when he wrote to tell me this, I said, "I'm getting on the next plane and coming to photograph you guys. This is like a lifetime movie, you know."
And are they still together?
They recently broke up after like 2.5 years together. And when I went back for these releases, they were so fearful that I wouldn't want them in the book because they broke up. And to me, when I was there photographing them, in my heart, I knew they weren't going to stay together because they put all these
charades, facades, pretenses.
They put so much emphasis on Chris, bringing them together, mm-hmm. and it was supposed to be this way, and it was too many expectations they had. So I knew that, it wouldn't work in my heart. And I said, it just proves that you're like everybody else. Of course it didn't work.
Now, is that do you think that's the saddest story in the book?
There's some pretty, pretty sad.
Yeah.
The other young guy that died was the son of a testicular cancer survivor, a young teenager, like 13, mm-hmm. I think, who was diagnosed with brain cancer. And he was at the end of his, life. They had tried all conventional medicines and, he was so pumped up on steroids and they were grasping at straws and mm-hmm. they really wanted to be in the book and share that story. And it was so hard for me to go there, but I did my crying beforehand. The kid had touched so many people's lives. He had started a foundation called Brain Candy for other families who have kids with cancer. And he affected thousands and thousands of other, families and kids and touched so many people. And I was so moved by seeing all the stories, and he had a blog and, Flickr mm-hmm. account with all these pictures. But when I got there, I was really affected. He couldn't keep his head upright. And I had, his father and his dad's partner come in and support his head with their heads and close their eyes and just think about the love they had for each other. And, it's a really moving story. And that was the sort of, the heart of my project for so long. It's a very sweet image, and their story is certainly moving and sad. And they ended up breaking up as well. After 3 months after Cameron passed away, Henry's partner, Scott, walked out on the relationship with no explanation. And Henry didn't really want to have that image be part of the book. He was so hurt mm-hmm. that to look at that same image over and over again, he thought would just be too much for him. But, I managed
that usually
to convince
happens,
him.
Yeah. Right? When couples lose a child, the stress of losing that child is so intense that they break up after that.
Yeah, and you reach a point probably where you kind of blow up, mm-hmm, and
sure.
So it didn't surprise me. I thought, this just proves that you're like everybody else.
Yeah, because it's typical for straight parents, for opposite sex parents that when they have a kid.
But it's like, what's interesting, maybe, there's a criticism that the book gets is like, why aren't lesbians in this book? Or why aren't genderqueer people in this book?
Where are the trans men?
Or why isn't me or my friends and you wanted to limit this to a very specific type of person.
Right. Gay men. It's my world.
But even like specific types of gay men too, like people who maybe like bisexual men or men who sometimes identify as gay or... guys on the down low.
Well, if they had written me their story and they would be honest about it, but certainly they couldn't be on the down low and share it with the world. Mm-hmm. And bisexual guys also, I think, didn't reach out to me. Maybe because I was saying, I wanted to find out gay men that mm-hmm. they didn't really answer the ads that I put out there.
But I think it's fascinating because now we're getting a picture of what that word and that phrase means. And so when somebody identifies as that, we can turn to your book and say, this is kind of like that mindset that's going right now.
Yeah. I tried my best to vary it. I really
because Rosie's not going to have you on her new show, which might actually be a favor to you. And I think this is an interesting thing, is that there's this double standard that some lesbians have in media and entertainment, where they is nothing wrong with them making it all about the women. But when somebody like you comes along, they're very upset and threatened about the fact that you made it all about the guys.
All about the men, right? With the title, I think. It's a matter of semantics, really, because it is called Gay in America. And gay technically can, it's the same attraction to the same sex. So
mm-hmm. The Ellen gay.
There is no word that is specifically for men, and that's what we... gay is as close as it comes. So mm-hmm. whereas lesbian is a woman, and a gay, but you... I equate it to, this was my first project. This was my firstborn. And like any artist or screenwriter or novelist, you go out and you photograph your world. Anybody will tell you to do that. It's the strongest, usually the strongest body of work to start with. And that's what I did here. I originally started to advertise in some lesbian chat rooms, and the ads that I put out just got deleted. So I would have had to masquerade as a lesbian in order to find lesbians, and that was not
gay
girl
in Damascus
wanted to do.
Kind of thing happening.
You could be Les Get Real.
I mean,
I think half the lesbians in chat rooms, you know, on different forums, are really just men, straight men pretending to be lesbians. There's something about it. It's not, they get off on it. They do.
But, you know, is that a fair criticism? And because so now you're telling me it's like when we were photographing you that that now you're like interested in doing a book about lesbians because of the challenge that would present.
I think it's hard. I think that this book will serve as a platform.
Sure.
You know, I'm on the radio now and I would love to do the same thing for women, but they shouldn't be in the same book. I think they should be companion volumes.
Because let's face it, having women in this book would be a total boner killer for men. Because there's a lot of guys that really, they fetishize this kind of stuff. They want to see real men, and they want to hear real men's stories. And for them, it's something that they, you know.
But is that getting us into trouble? Guys. Is there such a thing as an unreal man? Is there such a thing as a fake gay man?
No, not at all. I mean, they're all gay men in here. There's masculine and there's feminine gay men and flamboyant and, you know, manly men. So I tried my best to include every aspect of the gay community
but
as best I could.
But I think that's the key thing here, maybe, is in the words, is that it's men with their guards down.
Right.
You know, with a pretense put aside. And so we get humans showing their stories. But, what? You know, like Harnick and Paul from Seattle, Washington, one guy is a Sikh
right.
Indian, and then an African-American guy, and they are still probably together. I mean, these guys
they're
are
still
like,
together. Yeah.
They're like ready to merge, morph into one person. I mean, they're like having sex in the photo, basically. And how did they come together, and what's their story for you?
You know, it was just about their love for each other and how, you know, they both have very diverse, different backgrounds, but
and religious beliefs.
And religious beliefs, but they're opposites. Yeah. You know, in this case, those opposite factors and characteristics are what unite them and what attract them to each other. And they both can learn from each other. And they talk about, you know, they can go to each other's churches and, you know, they respect each other's different opinions. And to me, that was really refreshing.
So Harnick goes to Paul's like Episcopalian church and pulls out the tambourine and sings "Amazing Grace, how sweet thou art," like that.
I'd have to go back to them on that and ask.
Like, let me read you something. Paul is a software engineer and the coolest, hottest geek I have ever met, with a love of cars, video games, and Star Trek. I'm a project manager working in international public health, the social butterfly of the relationship, interested in travel, fashion, and shopping. Paul's a chef. I'm in charge of the cocktails at dinner parties. A perfect balance.
Well, for them it is, yeah. I mean, me and my partner are the same way. Opposites attract. So this was, I think, you know, visually I was more attracted to just their initial outward appearance. I mean, Harnick with his turban on his head.
Oh, yeah.
With an African-American black man makes just, I mean, you kind of are shocked in a little way. It's not the usual gay guys down the street that we think of.
No. Well, in summarizing this, I guess it is like it feels like you've almost done the job of the U.S. government to do a census of...
It's a record of our times.
Of our times. But, you know, what have you learned about romance and love and relationships for gay men that the listeners here can... What wisdom did you get out of it? Did you learn anything?
I learned a lot, but I think it opens many questions up, and more than it answers, perhaps.
What are some of the questions that you have?
That I have? Well, I think people are shocked, first off, that so many of the people are so ordinary looking and not what they think of when they, you know, when they visualize what gay men look like. You know, the media portrays us all a certain way. So, you know, I think that there are, I could do a volume two, I could do a volume three.
I mean, like us specifically, Mark and I, or like blogs or in general, are we somehow subconsciously putting out a message or an idea of what we expect and living up to that?
Look at the media out there. I mean, every
because we
gay
are
media,
the media
is buff and, you know, worked out and beautiful and,
well, I can help if I have a good body.
I know, you know, it's tough. Some of us are blessed, like you, but...
yeah, but I mean, seriously, like, do you think that that somehow focusing on athleticism and health is actually getting in the way of something.
Well, it, you know, I think the same could be said of, you know, women in the media as well, you know, that they're all glamorized and it's all about beauty and looks. And, you know, it's the same thing with gay men in many cases. It's all about, you know, your looks. And, you know, we set these expectations that we have to live up to, especially in gay, you know, very gay centric places, that in order to compete, we have to look a certain way. And I just was amazed that I found so many guys not buying into that around the country, who were just living their lives, didn't buy into any stereotypes. They, you know, and as it, you know, as it turned out, finding people in the bigger, larger gay meccas was more difficult for me.
Listen, you know? even Ryken Limecool and myself look ugly when we wake up in the morning.
Well, it's like when you're in a small town, though, it's like people know where the gays are. Oh, yeah, Bob, he lives down the corner to the right. He's the gay guy. You know, don't know exactly.
Yeah, you
got to
go over there. Bob's the gay guy. You want to interview him? Take a picture of him.
Exactly.
A lot of
the gay publishers that I went to with this turned it down because it wasn't homoerotic, and they felt that was really the only type of, you know, visual book that sells to the gay community.
Well, do you think you might do like a part two, the gays in America,
my way across the country? You know,
I'll take
it's the it. Next project. You know,
yeah. Scott, I'll help you with that project.
Dude, I'll carry the light kit.
Yes, I'll be doing the research. Lots of research. No, so Tom Kierdehy and Terrence McNally, the playwright and his partner, write the foreword to the book, and in a sense, they sort of like are the first couple in the book. Right. Next to you and your partner. What's your relationship with them? It's like, how'd you guys come together to, you know?
Well, I mean, I had always known of Terrence's work as a gay man and been very impressed with it. But when we were brainstorming on who to approach for the introduction, you know, we had a big, long list of people. And we sent out letters to all of them. And
who else did you want to get that you didn't?
Yeah, I'm not going to name names. I'm not going to do it.
I know we were on the list.
Right. You guys would have been top on the list. But my publisher, Lena Tabori, was listening. I'm not sure whether it was Diane Rehm or Fresh Air or something, but yeah. Tom was being honored for his work in the center in New York. He's a big gay rights advocate. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he was married to Terrence and they were 25 years apart in age could offer very different perspectives on the gay community. And it just hit my publisher.
She said they
would be amazing for this book. And she came to me and asked my opinion. And I said, absolutely. And
so you didn't know the guys personally?
Not personally, no. It was.
Have you met since?
Yeah.
Yeah, they took their picture.
Yeah. I went to see Masterclass last month. And Tom gave me the star treatment, me and my partner. So it was really nice. He's a great guy. You know, they both are wonderful.
I adore Tom. And I turned to Terrence and I said, girl, you got lucky.
Lucky. Terrence did good, yeah.
Because Terrence has been lovers with a lot of people in through the years, including the famous
Edward
playwright
Albee.
Edward Albee. You know, so he's, you know, had an interesting dating past and romantic past.
And your mother
and my mom.
Although your mother says they were just friends in high school.
Well, you know, what kind of what does a gay man do with his female best friend in high school? They date. You know, they're sitting on there's a fabulous photo of the two of them sitting on the hood of a car or in a backyard. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly where, but they're holding hands. And I'm like, come on. Aww. You know, that would have been interpreted as dating, I think, at that time period in the 1950s, at least, you know. And so I think it's great that you got them. And to me, they're just one of my favorite gay couples. The love and admiration that Tom has for Terrence on a personal level, because he's such a well-known playwright. Mm-hmm. and has created the careers of so many people. You know, Rosie Perez and Nathan Lane wouldn't have the careers that they have today if it wasn't for Terrence McNally. Angela Lansbury owes a lot to him, too.
Yeah, yeah, you know? They're good friends with Angela. I see Tom posts his Facebook pictures of being in Scotland with Angela. I'm like, wow.
Was that Scotland? I thought it was Ireland.
Ireland? Yeah, Ireland. Ireland. Yeah.
She's an Amazon.
She's tall.
She's enormous.
You wouldn't think. You'd think she'd be the petite little lady.
Do you want me to share with you a funny story?
Sure.
My mom and I were hanging out with all those people and Terrence and Tom for a 70th birthday party at Sardi's in New York City. And all the people were, especially the old people, know who Angela Lansbury is. So they're all like, oh, I love you, and, you know, bed knobs and broomsticks or some, you know, on this TV show, or is it the TV show that she did?
Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah. Oh, they're all like, you know, all these old people like having like orgasms over Murder, She Wrote, you know, and she's just kind of like, thank you so much. Doris Roberts, the mother of
Everybody
Loves Raymond, is also one of these actors that owes a lot and has a close friendship to Terrence McNally, because his plays have kind of like defined their careers for them as they originated the roles in Broadway. And so Doris Roberts, all these old people are approaching Doris Roberts and like, I'm sorry, I know you're famous, but I have no idea what you do. And Doris Roberts turns, my dear, have you ever heard of the show called Everybody Loves Raymond? No, I don't watch television. Were you on Murder, She Wrote? And so Doris Roberts chasing Angela Lansbury throughout the entire night and turning to me, it's like, young man, will you take my picture with Angela Lansbury? And I was like, yes, I would love to. Only if you come on the talk show. And she said, of course I would love to go on your talk show. What's it called? Feast of Fun. Oh, I love to have fun. Let's have our photo taken together. And so I took this gorgeous photo of the two women and I sent her an email. Heard nothing back. But, you know, I mean, Angela Lansbury is really a truly elegant, just a force of nature. And it's like, I just think it's remarkable when anybody can get so emotionally close to somebody else like that, you know? And so anyways, that's my anecdote there. And just wanted to share it with you because I think it's a funny story. But
let's talk about Rosie O'Donnell's new talk show.
Let me just make a disclaimer here that this show in no way should be the template for anybody's doing a talk show. And the excitement and the idea of having an openly gay person, a lesbian woman like Rosie O'Donnell of distinction, who is very progressive, very pro-arts, in my own backyard in Chicago doing a talk show is amazing and remarkable and should be celebrated and applauded. But the problem is, it's also Rosie. And Rosie is kind of, you know, a person who's shell-shocked by the fact that she held on to the secret, I think, of being a lesbian woman and internalized that through, as she says, abusing alcohol through her years and still is struggling with that in some senses. And being a talk show host is a really delicate, difficult thing to do successfully in order, especially when you're throwing a lot of money, putting it at 6 p.m. at night, which is a tricky time period. I don't know if the show is going to last very long. They're doing this 5 days a week.
Wow.
And
yesterday's show was live.
It was live and had about the charm of Rosie's Thanksgiving special.
Her variety show that she did like 2 years ago?
Yeah. And it was one crazy disjointed thing after another. And I was like, you're having Oprah's team. These are the people who produce the world's most watched talk show ever. The Oprah Winfrey Show producing this hot mess. And it is a hot mess. I mean, it from the beginning where...
Well, I thought her opening act, though, when she came out and did her comedy bit, wasn't too bad. There were some funny jokes in there. But then it was just like, Suze Orman pops up and, you know, Oprah pops up at the end of the show. We're like, we're all here. We're rooting for you, Rosie. Please don't go batshit crazy on us.
She puts up Russell Brand as her first guest. And she's like gushing about how she's hot for him. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like going, you know, that didn't really work too well with Tom Cruise. Right. And now it just looks cool. Like she's showing him. It's kind of like when you stand next to a chubby person in a photograph to make yourself look thin.
Yeah.
You know, she's standing next to Russell Brand so she doesn't look so crazy.
But then she opens her number and she's got all these hot shirtless guys come out and dance around. And then she's just like, you know, she's like looking like, look, there's sexy guys. And she goes, I'm gay, I'm not dead. Which kind of like, I don't know, is weird and insulting to lesbians, I would think.
Yeah, because it's saying like, you know, all lesbians hate men. And that all lesbians don't find men attractive and stuff. And I'm just like, oh, come on, people. This is 2011.
And then she does this game show called The Row Game.
So, where all the answers have the word row in it.
And so the grand prize is a trip to Jamaica won by a gay man. Does she have no people on her staff that are aware that Jamaica is like one of the most gay unfriendly places in the world?
Hostile.
Like violent, gay people get like dangerous. Murdered. Like not the tourists, but the people that live there. It's just, it's not a good place. And you shouldn't be like sending a gay person there.
Yeah, it would be like, I guess all the plane tickets to, you know, Iran
were too expensive.
Or something.
Apple Vacations doesn't have it there. Send her to Portugal where they have, or Spain where they have gay marriage or something.
I hope that the winner at least was able to trade his ticket to
someplace.
Probably
not.
Better.
He's going to Jamaica and he's going to end up being dragged through the streets. We'll see what happens.
I mean, can you imagine if the contestant on her debut show gets murdered because of he won the
was
contest?
Was that her debut show?
Yeah,
yes. Yeah, it was her debut show.
Wow.
Oh, so. Man, I got to tell you. And then so all of a sudden, we go from her, you know, interviewing Russell Brand, who can't, who's ADD. You know, I think like people who struggle with substance abuse, they're part of them is that their attraction is that it helps calm down that part of their brain is just going 100 million miles a minute, you know? And Russell Brand is just like, he's still holding on to sanity, you know?
And barely.
I mean, you could see that he's just like, oh, man, I would love to smoke a rock right now with Rosie. You know, he's just sitting there and you're cut. So that's kind of fascinating. But once it starts getting interesting, they cut away to Russell Brand's pet project in California, which is a halfway home for very attractive blonde women who are addicted to crack. And so...
I think I missed that part.
It was weird. And then they cut to the Rogaine. And then later on in the show, it just kind of all falls apart. And then... At the end, though,
Rosie, after she's done with her interview, she's like, if you want to find out more about Russell Brand, just Google him.
So, Russell, because you didn't get the proper promotion on Rosie's show, we're going to give it to you for free here today. Go to russellbrand.tv. Mm-hmm. And learn about Russell Brand or follow him on Twitter at
there
Russell
you go.
Brand.
That's what you need to do. Right.
God damn it.
Just Google him. That's lazy journalism. What's your website again? Gaysinamerica.com?
Gayinamerica.us.
Oh, really? US. And you have a Twitter account.
Yeah.
And it'll be set
gay
up.
Gay in America
after...
as well. And or actually, Facebook? It's underscore gay in America.
Underscore gay in America.
The other one was taken. And, you know, we have a Facebook page as well, Gay in America. And all sorts of interesting information on there. And talking about our tour, I'm out on a 6-week tour right now, nationally across the country.
So where are you going? Like, I know you're going to be in Wisconsin and in Minnesota the next couple of days, but overall, you're going everywhere?
Yeah, pretty much. We've been, you know, 5 cities so far, Seattle, Portland, LA, San Fran, and we're going back to New York after this for a couple big events there. And then I head to Houston and Dallas and Atlanta and Miami and Lauderdale and Columbus, Ohio and Rehoboth Beach.
Lots of gays in Columbus.
Palm Springs, back to San Francisco and... DC, Boston, yeah, all over. So, you know, we need people coming to these events. It's tough to get people to come to any author signing, but I'm doing a great presentation and, you know, it's, I think, a worthwhile thing to do.
Right on.
I think it's fantastic and we really recommend people getting this book. Let's go really fast through some of the news items. A trans woman's been elected to parliament in Poland. So it's not the president of Poland is a trans woman, but kind of, I guess that's the equivalent of a senator or of a representative.
Yeah, it's like a congressperson. So her name is Anna Grodzka, and she's become Poland's first openly transgendered parliamentarian. So I want to do a shout out to all our listeners in Poland, to Pavel. We do have listeners in Poland. He's laughing, but...
No, I believe you. I have a good Facebook friend from Poland who just posted today.
Yeah. And, you know, they're all really hot.
Well, and the great thing about Poland, though, is because, you know, they're not really the most gay-friendly of all places. I mean, they're certainly better than Russia, but it's like, you know, that's a sign of the times. I mean, if you, you know, because when you elect somebody that's transgender, it's, you know, it's part of our community. And so they're saying yes to that. So it's a signifier of change. Which is wonderful.
I can't wait a vacation in Poland. I would feel much safer in Poland than in Jamaica. Rosie. Oh, my God. There's so many things wrong with it. Listen, I'm going to just be really, really frank here and say, let's give her a chance. Mm-hmm. Let's give her a break. You know,
we're going to give her a break.
She's been through hell. Mm-hmm. She's had a hard life somehow, you know. And so maybe this will iron itself out. I would think Rosie should pay attention to Oprah's masterclass or her life
class. That was the weird thing.
Afterwards, because Oprah's saying what?
It was all about ego. And I think that's what most people criticize Rosie for, is that her ego gets in the way of everything. And so Oprah's masterclass is how to tame your ego right after Rosie's show. And I'm like, is that kind of passive aggressive? It doesn't really seem like Oprah's style. Oprah would just be like, listen, girl, I would think she would be very forthright with what she would have to say. So,
well, maybe, you know what it was, that they had a conversation about the ego, and Oprah went, you know what? This will be a great show. Mm-hmm. And the thing about the Oprah's life class, it feels like her video blog.
It is her video blog. She's just sitting in front of a camera talking.
And Rosie really shined for me and throughout her whole career. My favorite project that she's ever done, because I'm a fan of hers, is her video blog when she wasn't wearing any makeup. She was just
very real. Yeah,
you and gritty and
drinking Miller Lite.
Miller Lite, you know, and just like really, there's something really healing and entertaining and fascinating to see somebody vent and express their anger and frustration. And when we don't see that, and that's the thing about Rosie's live show, is that she's like ready. All that Rosie wanted to do is to pull out a baseball bat and beat up a dummy of Barbara Walters. And we didn't get to see that.
When I did see her on TV yesterday, briefly, some friends where I'm staying, and the first reaction I had was to how much makeup she was wearing. And it didn't seem like her, in a way.
It's not the, we're feeling, you know, and this is the kind of thing with your book. It's like, when you see somebody who's like, you know, creating this candy shell outside of their personality, it turns us off instinctively as human beings. So, you know, maybe when Rosie starts to, because, you know, when she says like, I may be, you know, gay affirmative, but this show's nothing about gay and nothing about politics. I'm like, great, Rosie, you're not going to express what's on your mind.
Right, like what else are you going to contribute then? I mean, that's what she's good venting herself.
I think she's going after that same market that Ellen is after, the nursing home market. So, you know, she figures if Ellen can get out there and dance on television for 5 minutes and make money doing it, then Rosie can just do anything too.
But do old people, like old women, watch television at 6 p.m. at night? Sure. Usually they're eating dinner and going to bed.
No, they eat at 5. At six,
that's their prime time.
It's probably a choice between that show or Wheel of Fortune, and maybe they'll get tired of Wheel of Fortune and turn over to Rosie.
Like, my mother's not going to watch that show. I can just tell you
but
right
now.
But
my mother might. You know,
well, yeah.
Because, you know, she probably remembers Rosie as being the queen of nice, and then they're like, oh, I think she became a lesbian, and then I don't know what happened. But, like, gay people are more involved in that whole, like, her becoming, like, you know, this, you know, bad haircut lesbian.
Well, it was kind of like Samson, you know, when they cut Samson's hair off in the Bible, he loses his strength. And with Rosie, when they cut off her hair, she lost her niceness. I'm just kidding. So actors at the set of Resident Evil, there was a horrible accident and something like fell on 16 extras, all wearing full zombie makeup. Mm-hmm. So the paramedics showed up to the Toronto set of the film, Resident Evil Retribution, and they were like life-threatening diseases, but the paramedics showed up there and they're like, hold on a second.
What's real?
What's real? What is it? You know, it's like, because that does happen from time to time. People dressed up in costumes get injured, and then the paramedics come and they're like, they can't separate the fake blood injuries from the real blood.
Well, and one time there was a zombie crawl in our neighborhood here in Andersonville, and witnessed a woman hit collapsed.
She had too much to drink.
She was having a seizure or something?
She collapsed. She was having a seizure. She was on the sidewalk. She was dressed as a zombie. So it was hard to tell if the zombie makeup had something to do with it, or did her symptoms exasperate her zombiness? And then all these people dressed up as zombies were around her.
Also drunk. Swaying back and forth. Moaning.
And then the ambulance comes over, and I'm just like, I'm so transfixed by this scenario because it's, I'm like going, well, I'm sure their brains are exploding. The paramedics are going, what the hell's going on here? So hopefully all those people got to get medical treatment and they're doing much better.
So Dan Choi, you know, he's on trial because he was arrested, chained up to the White House. And so he had a little setback in his case because he was trying to put forward a defense saying that I was targeted because I'm famous. People know who I am and that this prosecution is hostile towards me. And the judge said, I'm sorry, you can't use that as a defense. So I don't know what's going to happen to him.
Because they had agreed initially, and now they disagree.
Who agreed initially?
In his defense, he said that
it looked like it was going to be. It was going well. That defense would hold up.
Right, and then now the judge said no. that's not going
to
hold.
Yeah, that Lindsay Lohan defense ain't going to cut mustard around here. Well, you like got to get close to Dan Choi.
And yeah, he's a friend now. Yeah,
he's a cover of your book.
I was just emailing him yesterday, but I wasn't asking him about that. So I'll turn around today and I'll say, what's going on, Dan? Tell me.
You've been sort of criticized for having him on the cover, at least by one woman on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was it was a guy. He was in at the book signing in Seattle, and he really had no idea who Dan Choi was. And Dan Choi's name came up in the Q&A, and we were talking about how he's been a somewhat divisive figure in the community. Mm-hmm. And
how is he really divisive?
Well,
though?
I think a lot of people just think, you know, they use that word media whore. You know, a lot of people are sick of Dan in the gay community, and he's come out pretty strong against Obama. In terms of Obama's stance on gay marriage.
He's been critical about Obama.
He's been very critical about Obama. And
he's not become a Tea Partier and saying people should vote for Republicans either.
Right. So you have, I had somebody who was very pro-Obama who just got mad that I would put somebody like that on the cover. And, you know,
I
think it's all about...
Do you worry that it politicizes your book and maybe it makes people like... misunderstand the goals and the aspirations of the book?
Personally, no. I mean, I think it's all about diversity and trying to learn from people that are different than yourself. Mm. So if, you know, he doesn't agree with Dan's political thought, that, you know, that doesn't, you know, mean that Dan's wrong, you know, and to get mad because somebody different than yourself is part of this project, it seems, you know, sort of prejudiced in and of itself. So,
did you take any photos of Dan, like, chained up to, like, his bed or anything? It's like, part of the, it's my long-running joke that it's part of his actual, it's his fetish. That's my mother.
Oh. That's your mom calling on the phone? Should we put her on the show?
No.
Hey, we got to call you back.
So. But, you know, to me, I needed an advocate in the book. And I thought with what's going on with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it was, you know, I needed somebody in the military who, and to have Dan and, you know, part of the project. It wasn't that I photographed him with the intent of putting him on the cover. Mm-hmm. It, after spending a long time, you know, looking at the photographs we had and the options we had. He seemed right for the cover and to make people really take a hard look and question and stop and think. You know, here is an Asian military man on the cover of a book of gay men in America. Mm-hmm. And that might make some people pick up the book and think about it. And
who's fluent in Middle Eastern
Arabic
language?
Yeah.
Well, it's also too. It's, you know, it's because, you know, we're all in a way soldiers.
Right.
You know, we
have
to overcome.
He is our soldier. He's everybody's soldier in the book, regardless of his political thought. Mm-hmm. And you know, in posting all of these, you know, we've had a Facebook page, and I've been, you know, leading up to the book's release, we posted a new spread on Facebook every day. And in the corner of all these spreads, we put that image of the cover on there. And Dan, you know, kept on reappearing. And, you know, I couldn't imagine doing that with any other picture in the book. Mm-hmm. It just seemed that he was all of our soldier. He's out there to protect, you know, gays, you know. And
okay,
he's
you're
done
in
his,
love with him.
I, you know, Dan has done, you know, I think it's
but
a very,
a
very
lover.
Difficult thing to be an advocate. Mm-hmm. I don't wish it on anybody. I think it's a very difficult path to choose. And
I think he kind of gets off on it, to be honest. You know, it's like,
well, I think he's
I don't know, I've seen a little different
he's
side.
Passionate.
I think it's tough. I think he's now in a position where he might not, you know, have a lot of other options. But to hear him speak and to hear him, you know, he's so passionate about gay rights, and I think he has a future in politics if he can figure out how to do that. He definitely is the Rosa Parks of, you know,
wild,
the gay community in many people's eyes.
Wild women do not get the blues, and he's doing his life's work. And whether you agree with him or disagree with him, one thing you can say is that crazy people change the world.
Absolutely.
That's what Steve Jobs said.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you got to follow your convictions. And when you do so, you're going to meet resistance. You're going to get the snobs of the gay world looking down upon you because they feel bad about themselves, and they feel better when they see somebody who's self-actualized, who's actually doing their passion. If they look down upon you, then their pain and their failures and their misfires don't seem so bad.
Yeah.
And that's why I think people are looking down on Dan Choi, really. Because, you know, I think every gay person has been frustrated with any standing U.S. president. But President Obama has been remarkably good for gay people.
Right. And look at what's happened under his watch. You know, and it's just because he's evolving on gay rights doesn't mean that might not be a very calculated political maneuver.
And I think we all know it is.
It is totally a calculated maneuver.
It bonds him with the right with the conservatives. So, and it's served as an argument between Dan and me. But, you know, being a gay rights advocate.
Hold on a second. So do you think that Dan feels like that President Obama isn't more savvy than he lets off to be?
I'm not going to put words in Dan's mouth.
I think, though, the other thing is you have to. We need people like Dan to put pressure on him. Right, otherwise, you're not going to have him say anything.
The more he puts pressure on him, the more he says, you have to, you know, screw this evolving thing. You know, you got to, you know, with what happened in New York, to have Cuomo come in and really stand up for gay rights. And, you know, he's become this icon figure in the gay New York community now for all the good he's done. But, you know, Obama came to New York for that fundraiser and couldn't stand up and say the same thing. It was really disappointing in my eyes as well, you know.
Sure. And listen, President Obama says, put pressure on me. So, you know, it's kind of like he's asking for people like Dan Choi to come forward and take a stand like that.
And it's like, we're not going to get anything done, you know, unless we have these people like occupying Wall Street. There's not going to be any kind of change. Obama needs these people. He needs these people to stand up and say, we must do this.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, the Obama administration's behind the Occupy Wall Street a little bit more than we realize.
Maybe
just a tiny bit.
Listen, I want to remind the listeners that Podcast Awards season is upon us. So please visit podcastawards.com and vote for your favorite podcast. And hopefully it's this one in the GLBT category and in the top choice of People's Choice.
I want a gay podcast to win the top prize this year.
Right.
And might as well be us.
That might as well be us.
It should be.
It should be. Feast of Fun. Would you rather want anything else like Feast of Sadness?
No.
Feast of Frustration?
No.
Feast of Responsibility? No, it's Feast of Fun. And this is one of the funnest things. You will never. We do the kind of programming you're not going to get on NPR or Fresh Air or This American Life. In fact, this is the type of programming you're definitely not going to hear. Ira Glass, the host of This American Life's Sex Tape.
Sex Tape.
Now, this is produced by Julian Jocelyn and Michael Grinspan. So let me reiterate to the listeners, this is not Ira Glass. This is not Ira Glass. This is not a very dirty episode of This American Life. This is a parody. So because listening to this and play it for people, they're just going, wow, that's amazing. So this is 11 minutes of the too raunchy for NPR Ira Glass's Sex Tape. Listen to this.
Hey, America. Ira Glass here. So a few weeks ago, I think, you know, it seems like every celebrity has a sex tape. Paris Hilton, Pamela Anderson, Tommy Lee, the original sex tape, Rob Lowe, Tila Tequila, Tanya Harding, and even John Edwards. So I started thinking, you know, you're a celebrity, Ira. Why don't you have a sex tape? You know, why not? Well, from WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life, distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Ira Glass. Each week, of course, we pick a theme and bring you a variety of stories on that theme. This week's theme, my sex tape. Today's show in two acts, yes, two whole mouth-watering acts. Act one, Ain't Too Proud to Craig, where we try out using Craigslist as it was meant to be used. I don't mean to buy a futon. Act two, Gross Indecency, where we talk about the intricacies of intimacies, embarrassments, triumphs, all of it. We don't hide anything. We talk about it all. Stay with us.
I believe in miracles. Way from you sexy things.
Act one. Ain't Too Proud to Craig. Now, over 500,000 people may download my podcast each week, making me the most popular person I know. But when it came to finding that one special person, you know, the Kim Kardashian who would ride to infamy on my celebrity, so to speak. Turns out, she's not so easy to find. I asked the producers of our show for advice. I gotta say, I did not receive much encouragement. Here's Jonathan Goldstein.
I just think like we're opening a whole can of worms here that we don't want to be doing. This whole thing is gonna lead to heartbreak somehow.
Finally, our senior producer, Julie Snyder, had the genius idea to put a post on Craigslist. I enlisted the help of the slightly more macho half of the Planet Money team, and Ira Glass wannabe, Alex Bloomberg, to help me compose an ad. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Ira.
So, Alex, I'm just, like, terrible at going after girls.
I would not have thought that you would have had that problem. You have the testosterone of two linebackers.
I wish. But seriously, like what do I write in this ad?
Well, I've been thinking about that. And were there specific things that you were hoping for?
You mean just, like, a list of, like, what I like in a woman and what I'm looking for?
Yeah, like a grocery list, exactly.
Jonathan still didn't like it. Here he is again, killing our buzz.
Just, I don't know, there's something just kind of, like, reductive and kind of unhuman about it. That, yeah.
This went on for a while. Finally, we decided, write what you know. And what do we know? Pledge drives. Okay, Alex, here's what we got. If you think nerdy intellectuals with nasally voices are sexy, then please, won't you support us? For the simple donation of your time, your dignity, you can keep quality, thought-provoking sex tapes on the internet for years to come. And next to that, we have a winky face. If you donate now, Carl Castle will leave a dirty, and I mean really filthy, message on a loved one's answering machine. Call now.
There's not very much pornographic about that.
Well, I told you, I'm not very good at this.
I'll say. Wow.
Well, it's been 3 days, and we've already gotten two anonymous responses, which we're about to open. The first one says, I already have a dirty message from Carl Castle, but meet me Friday in the NPR News headquarters boiler room. Bring handcuffs and a whip. Okay, no thank you, Lakshmi S. Number two is from someone who calls herself the Stamburglar at Yahoo. Okay, you know what, I'm not even going to open that one. It was time to swallow my pride and call the one person I knew I could count on, but it was not going to be a fun conversation.
Gross.
Terry, it's Ira. Please don't hang up. Listen, I owe you an apology.
Is there anything you wish you had done differently?
Yeah, there is. I wish I had told you when I started seeing Cokie.
So, in other words, you lied a little bit.
No, I never lied to you.
You ended up being a hustler.
Terry, I always said I was bad at commitment.
You say you've had sex with about 4,600 people.
Something like that.
But my impression is you don't have much sympathy for anyone. You're so into yourself.
I know. I'm sorry. This American life was blowing up. I was getting drunk off the fame. You know, I thought I was the Brad to your Jennifer, but it turned out I was the Bruce to your Demi. I mean, if only because of your G.I. Jane haircut.
That's a really obnoxious thing to say.
No. I like your haircut. Terry, can I just tell you why I'm calling?
Go ahead.
I'm calling because I'm making a celebrity sex tape, and I want you to be in it.
Having sex with you?
Well, yeah. After a conversation that is a little too graphic for public radio, I'd made some progress.
I think it's just, like, irresistible what's going on.
What are you wearing, Terry?
A leather corset, fishnet stockings.
Oh my gosh. What else?
Like spike thigh-high boots.
And that's when I knew. I was about to do what neither Click nor Clack had ever had the balls to. I was actually gonna tap it, brother. Just say no to this relationship. We could be best friends with benefits. Coming up, what happens when you add two NPR superstars, a microphone, and subtract all clothing? That's in a minute from Chicago Public Radio and Public Radio International when our program continues. That's where we draw the line. We've reached Act 2 of our program. Act 2, Gross Indecency. I arrived at Terry's house to find the lights turned down low, candles from Whole Foods, and jazz on Terry's 8-track. We got into bed and started recording. Testing. Test 1, 2. Okay.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ira Glass. On radio, when you do your introductions, there's something like really naked about it. I mean,
well, yeah, that's because I record them totally naked. I'm serious. Like you should see what happens when I announce the theme each week. Like I literally couldn't do the intro to the debt crisis episode because all the blood had drained from my head.
People love how you sound on the radio, and you look great on TV. So.
And how do I look in your bedroom, or as I like to call it, your NPR member station?
Ooh. You know it's going to be odd for people hearing this?
What?
You actually use, like, oohs and ahs.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I prefer really loud sex.
And why does really loud appeal to you?
Because otherwise I wouldn't be able to hear you over the sound of my own neuroses.
You'd be thinking, well, it's not loud enough, it's not loud enough.
Exactly. Like, I wasn't turning you on as much as, like, William Buckley Jr. That conservative prick had nothing on me. I was about to get freaky in the most liberal sense of the word. Is that turning you on, Terry?
Not really, to be honest with you.
How about this?
You're looking for a groove.
Let's try a different position.
You've done the crotch thing, too, right?
I don't know if I have. What's it called?
The wiener circle.
Oh, is that the move where the girl has the guy on the floor and then...
They kind of like grab their crotch.
Yeah, in Chicago we actually call that move cock of the nation.
Yeah, like how did that start? Like who started that?
I actually learned about it from Peter Sagal's sex blog, Wait, Wait, Don't Come Yet.
We'll do the clean version.
Okay. Oh, how does that feel?
It's like, whoa. It's like...
Yeah? Yeah, this is... Oh my god, oh my god. This is really turning me on.
That's contagious.
Ooh. Oh. Ooh. Is this stuff good for you?
This stuff is so good.
Good.
Does that give you pleasure?
Yeah, yeah.
Am I rough enough?
Yeah, a little too rough, actually. Oh, not yet, not yet, not yet! Well, not all of us can last as long as Tom Ashbrook's attention. I made a little small talk, just to be nice. Then I was out of there.
It's been really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. I had a really great time. So there you have it, folks. We accomplished what we set out to do. Maybe a little faster than we might have liked. Nonetheless, it was fun. But even in the face of our success, questions remain. At the beginning of our show, we asked, why not? Now the question is, why? Why would we want to join a tradition of celebrity that has caused nothing but scandal and publicity? At the end of the day, we NPR hosts are not sexy. We're not. People don't have posters of me in their dorm rooms. They don't think about me in nothing but my glasses. That unsexiness is part of what defines us. But is that something we want? Is that something I want? Maybe the very fact that we made this tape answers that question. But I think that there's more to it than that. I think this hints at a truth about NPR hosts, about celebrities, and about people in general that we don't like to admit very often. We can't choose who we are. Some people are Ryan Gosling. Some people are William Buckley Jr., and some are slightly whiny Jewish radio hosts. But we do have options. We can either sit back and be the person we've always been, the person who people have told us we were, or we can be that sexy celebrity. We can be Rob Lowe. If you think about it like that, maybe today's episode is a way of proving, of shouting, to the furthest reaches of NPR radio waves and wherever the bandwidth of our podcast manages to fit, announcing at the top of my lungs, we don't choose who we are, but we do choose who we become. And maybe, just maybe, we get to have some fun on the way. Well, our program today was produced by myself, Nancy Updike, Sarah Koenig. Our senior producer is Julie Snyder. Thanks to Alex Bloomberg and Jonathan Goldstein for their Craigslist expertise. Very special thanks to our guest, Terry Gross. We have to say, he's anything but. WBEZ management oversight is provided by our boss, Mr. Tori Malatia, who would not believe Jonathan Goldstein when he said he'd never tried touching himself. Here's what he had to say.
So, but really, like, you've done the crotch thing too, right?
I'm Ira Glass, back next week with more stories of this American life.
Too hot that was for great. This wow. American life and too hot for NPR, just like Feast of Fun.
I always knew Terry Gross had it in her.
Yeah, I did not realize that Terry Gross is heterosexual woman. Our guest today has been Scott Passfield. The book is Gay in America. We recommend that you get it. You can buy it through our links on our website, feastoffun.com, with an introduction by Terrence McNally and Tom Kierdehy. And the cool thing about the book, it's a coffee table book, so it makes a fabulous present. And you can buy a Feast of Fun t-shirt, or you can print photos of your friend and stick it in there and blow their minds, making them think that they're like
they're
in
a book.
You know?
And just make up a whole little story there.
Yeah,
you could just... That'd be a good gag.
You could just slip in a certain page and glue it into the spine of the book and just be like,
That's
my
a wonderful
friend,
gag.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Nothing would make me happier.
You would like that kind of stuff,
would,
you know?
I would, sure, yeah.
Any plans on a sequel?
I would, you know, there's a lot of talk and interest on doing Lesbian in America. So, you know, whether that's possible, whether a gay man can do that or not, I would love to be challenged and to try. If not, I'll head to Europe and do Gay in Europe.
You know, I want to see? Because this is, I know this is trendy and stuff, but it's like, I think transgendered individuals really best represent the circumstances that all LGBT people face on many, many complex levels and are also very visually interesting.
Sure.
And so as a photographer who wants to get the gritty,
transgender in America.
Man. Transgender in America to me seems like the book after this one that I would really rush out to buy just because I want to see
interesting.
The mind fuck that happens when we have gender expectations in photography. The fact that a lot of transgender people are performers, sex workers, athletes.
And I think a lot of people have said that they might need that book more to help people understand them better.
And there's lots of chasers out there.
Right, yeah.
Lots
so there's options for me, but it's definitely going to involve travel and taking pictures. So.
Yeah, awesome. So trans ladies out there, trans fellas, how can they contact you? Just send you a tweet? And
Or go to my site, scottpassfield.com. Send me an email, scott@scottpassfield.com. And there's all these links on the Facebook page and the site. You can find me, but I would love to hear from people.
I think I'm rooting for trans in America.
Well,
trans,
thank you.
It kind of works too, you know.
Trans,
you
could, yeah, just trans in America. Yeah.
And technically, you could put Dan Choi on the cover of both.
He'd love that.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me here. I appreciate it, guys.
We're going to leave you here with the music of the fabulous Tom Goss, Turn It Around. You can find his music on our website, Feast of Fun. We thank you so much for listening, and thank you for being a fabulous Feast of Fun supporter. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Summer in your steps. In your dreams not far behind, no. Just a whisper in your head. So hold on with your heart and dive up to your ears now. Take that whisper in your head and turn it back now. Sing it to me loud, loud. Exactly.